Well, this evening, you know, it's a great evening before us. As you know, God is into drama, and he loves stories. Just a quick review of the Old Testament, you find he has a donkey talking. Then you find Jonah in the mouth of a great fish. You find Daniel and his friends in the lion's den. You go to the New Testament, and you find a group like ours going to the funeral of a man, seeing him put in a tomb and buried. And then some days later, he's resurrected, walking around the town again. Jesus decided it'd be best to pay the IRS with a coin out of a fish's mouth. I mean, God is into drama, and he's into stories. And this evening, you're going to hear one of the most dramatic stories that you've probably ever heard. Our guest speaker tonight is Mr. Mark Whitaker, and God has done an amazing thing in his life. Some of you are familiar with the general account that the movie The Informant was made after. And Damon, what's his first name? Matt Damon. He got to star in the movie. And, of course, so we know that Mark Whitaker's story helped make Matt Damon rich and helped make him famous. So he has Mark to thank for that. And, you know, last night there was an event that I went to in Haymarket. And Mark spoke there. It's the first time I had heard him speak. And the conversation was riveting, but the story was filled with warnings and lessons, as well as praise and blessings. And to you young men that are here this evening, if you're in your, you know, before your 20s, in your 20s, right on up to your late 30s, there are a lot of things that Mark is going to talk about just in the context of his story. Don't get so riveted by the story he's telling that you miss the warnings. Because within this story, he'll communicate, you know, in the path of life, you can apply your heart to wisdom, and you can learn from older men and the failures and the struggles and the wrong responses they've had, or you can learn it the hard way, on your own, repeating and experiencing the consequences. And for those of us who are older or younger, you're going to hear a lot tonight that gives you inspiration, gives you hope, no matter what circumstances you're facing today. And so it's a real privilege and an honor for me to introduce Mark Whitaker. Mark, while you're coming up, one other thing I want to tell you that stood out to me last night. Mark goes around the country and tells this story. He's told it hundreds of times. And so you could imagine a man telling the same basic story 100 times or more, he could come off a little stale or flat. He was so incredibly sincere. He so cares and was energized by what he has to say and the message that God has given him. I was just so encouraged by that, so encouraged. So, Mark, as you come, let me open us in prayer and then let you begin. Holy Father and Lord Jesus Christ, what a great honor and privilege for us to have a wonderful meal and enjoy that and the conversation and fellowship this evening, and then be able to gather together to hear just what you've done in the life of Mark and Ginger Whitaker and their family. I ask that you'd touch our hearts and open them and our minds so that you might speak to us and that we might be tender and sensitive to the implications and the lessons that are in his story for us. Also energize us and inspire us to carry forth the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ and to represent you in all the ways and in all the places that we can. And we thank you in Christ's name. Mark?
Thank you. Thank you. Boy, what a wonderful opportunity to be here tonight. And thank you for having me and allowing me to share here. And I'm humbled and honored to be here. And I think when Will first contacted me, I guess almost about a year ago for this event, it's at least been 9 or 10 months, and said we'd come out here for this event. And then John English heard that I was going to be here. And so we've done 5 events since I've been here. So we've had a busy couple days, but blessed to be here. And thanks for coming and spending an evening by coming here. And look forward to share with you. I'd like to start off with this. When you go back to work, just imagine tomorrow, for example, tomorrow morning, that you wake up with a tape recorder attached to your body with an athletic band. I know that sounds odd, but just think about it. Another tape recorder in a briefcase, and a third tape recorder in a notebook. and a special notebook that you have, three different tape recorders. And you go to work, and you go to work all day, and you tape your coworkers, your supervisors, in some cases your friends. You're taping them. Unbeknownst to them, now imagine doing that every day for 3 years. I met four FBI agents at 6 o'clock. I was a lot younger, man, then. I was 32 years old. I'm 58 years old now. But when I was in my early 30s, 25 years ago, I met four FBI agents at 6 o'clock in the morning. They'd shave my chest, hook microphones to my chest, check the batteries in three different tape recorders, one with an athletic band, one in the briefcase, and one in the notebook. And they'd send me off to work by 7 in the morning after they met with me for an hour. And then I'd wear that wire till 6 o'clock in the evening and then meet with them again and turn over tapes and have the debriefings and take the polygraphs and all the things you have to do as an FBI informant. And I did that every day for 3 years, Monday through Friday. I was a keynote speaker at the Quantico FBI Academy not far from here a couple of years ago. I've had the opportunity to do 7 events for the FBI in the last 9 years. And at the Quantico FBI Academy, they informed me it was the longest duration of anybody wear a wire in U.S. history. No one's ever wore a wire every day, Monday through Friday, for 3 years. And all I could say is I don't think anybody's trying to break that record. Well, I'd like to talk about how I became an FBI informant, some huge mistakes that I made during that time I was an FBI informant, but what I've learned the last 20 years since is what I want to emphasize, what I've learned since that time. The company I was wearing a wire against is no average company. They're known as ADM. Archer Daniels Midland is their full name. ADM today is the 27th largest company in the Fortune 500 and $90 billion in annual revenue. When I joined them in 1989 at 32 years of age, 25 years ago, we were about $70 billion in annual revenue at that time. We had 30,000 employees. We were number 56th largest company in the Fortune 500 and the 90th largest company in the world when I joined them. And the best way to describe what ADM produces is the following. Whatever you had for breakfast today, lunch today, and dinner today likely had something from ADM in it. They're the largest food additive company in the world. It would be difficult to go to the grocery store and you buy a Kellogg's cereal, Kraft, Tyson Poultry, Pillsbury, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and orange juice. It would be difficult to buy a food or beverage that doesn't have something from ADM in it. They are the ingredients that feed the world. That are in our foods. And when I joined them, I was divisional president of the biotech division. So out of the 30,000 people in the company, 4,000 people were in my division. And I was corporate vice president of the whole company. And the CEO was 75 years old in 1989. He was there 30 years already. The president was 69 years old, and I was 32. And I was number 4 ranked executive in the company. And I never forget the first two employees they introduced me to. They had 7 Falcon 50s for the top executives, for the 7 top executives. And with me being number 4 in the company, the first day at work, October 1989, they had me at the corner office, showed me where my office was. They brought 2 pilots and introduced me to, and said these were 2 of the pilots that were going to be assigned to work with me for the Falcon 50 that they gave me. For the 7 top executives, and I was number 4, so I had my own Falcon 50, age 32, 1989. I'll never forget, I had my Justin Bieber, my Britney Spears, and my Charlie Sheen moment all in 1 month. I thought I was Bon Jovi. I even had hair back then, too, by the way. But I thought I was Bon Jovi to have that, a corporate jet, and the job that I had. I remember the CEO being 30 years there and being 75 years old. He lived in a huge house about 20 miles south of Decatur, Illinois, where our world headquarters were. And he wanted to move to something smaller, being 75 years old, near the airport. I often think he hired me just to buy his house. But he wanted to move to a smaller house. He lived in that house for 30 years. So he gave me a $500,000 startup bonus my first week if I would consider buying his house. So I bought his house. I moved my family to Decatur. The house had 13,000 square feet, 8-car garage. And in that 8-car garage, within a couple of months, I had the 8-car garage full of 8 cars. I had a Ferrari, 2 BMWs, 2 Mercedeses. Like I said, I thought I was Bon Jovi. I think the first day at work was about the start of my demise. During that period of time. So then you say, Mark, you're 32 years old. You're number 4 in one of the largest companies in the world with 30,000 employees. Why in the heck would you blow the whistle on your own company when your CEO's 75 and your president's 69 and your vice chairman's also in his 60s? Why would you blow the whistle when you had room to move up and when my future there was so bright? Well, the reason why I blew the whistle on ADM is because I didn't. My wife Ginger did, and that's a picture of Ginger there, my wife. And by the way, I've known Ginger since she was in seventh grade and I was in eighth grade. I met her when she was 13 years old and I was 14 years old, and my mom took us to the junior high dance and her mom took us home. We grew up in a real small town called Mar, Ohio, about a thousand people town, about an hour north of Cincinnati. And we grew up in that town, that real small town, and we met when she was in seventh grade and I was in eighth grade. We were the prom king and queen. I was senior class president of my class. She was a class behind me, a year behind me. She was treasurer of her class, and just a real small town with real good Midwestern roots during that time. And we've been married since 1979, 36 years next month. And I know, say, to marry 36 years don't mean a lot to a lot of you, but at the end of this story, it's a miracle of God that my wife stayed with me when you're going to hear what I put her through and my children through. It's a miracle of God. So she saw all these changes in me. She saw me getting obsessed to materialism. And we met, we were having a discussion on November 5th, 1992. So I'm 3 years with the company at that point, 3 years. And I'm 35 years old and she's 34 years old. And she set me down and she said, "Mark, you've become an addict." I said, "What do you mean an addict? I don't drink. I don't do drugs. What are you talking about, an addict?" She said, "I'm talking about a work addict. I'm talking about a workaholic." She said, "You've been at 3 years at that company. It's all you do is work." And I said, "Ginger, my base salary is $350,000 a year when I started. But in a public company, most of your income is in stock options and bonuses. With my stock options and bonuses and base salary, for the 7 years I was there, my contract was for $3 million a year with stock options, bonuses, and base salary." So I said, "Ginger, 90% of my income is based on performance parameters that I have to make. So the more I work, the more I earn. And that's why we have a house like this and cars like this. And that's why we live like this. Kids in private schools." And she said, "You know what, Mark? I'd rather have a 2,000 square foot house instead of 13,000 square feet. I'd rather have two Fords in the driveway instead of Ferraris, Mercedeses, BMWs, and so on, eight cars." And she said, "I'd rather have my husband at home." She said, "All this stuff doesn't mean anything to me like it means to you." So I said, "Well, look, Ginger," I said, I've been working here for 3 years now." And she started complaining about how I had to work at night. After dinner each night, I'd be on the phone for 3 or 4 hours at night. She said, especially the last 7 months. And I said, "Well, I have to be on the phone at night because it's 8 o'clock at night in Decatur, Illinois, is 8 o'clock in the morning in Southeast Asia. They're 12 hours ahead of us in South Korea, in Japan, in Singapore. So I have to be on the phone at night because they're 12 hours ahead of us." So she asked me who I was on the phone with, and I listed the company's names. She said, "Well, those are your competitors. Why would you be on the phone with them?" And I said, "Well, they assigned a mentor to work with me 7 months ago to show me how to do price fixing. How we get together our competitors, and we fix the prices of these ingredients. We have an international cartel, and we make a lot more money. We earn an extra $1 billion a year. Not a million, but $1 billion a year by doing this price fixing." She said, "Wow, that sounds strange. Is that legal?" I said, "It's not legal, but everybody's doing it. They told me they've been doing it for 12 years. And if you in the commodity business, if you don't do it, you don't survive." She said, "Yeah, but Mark, if you're only involved 7 months and you've only been there 3 years and it's been going on for 12 years, what a perfect time to expose this fraud." I said, "Honey, if I expose this fraud, I'd go to jail. We'd lose this home, these cars. I'd get fired. We'd lose everything." She said, "Well, who pays for this price fixing?" I said, "Basically, when someone goes to the grocery store, like all of you, and you buy $50 worth of groceries, you're paying an extra $2 or $3 for the price fixing of those ingredients. Because when Kellogg's or Coca-Cola or Pepsi or an orange juice company pays higher for those ingredients, they have their profit margin built in. So they're going to pass that on to you, the consumer. So you pay an extra $2 or $3 out of $50, I told her. She said, "You mean my grandma on $300 a week Social Security is paying extra money for groceries for us to live in a mansion in an eight-car garage?" She said, "I don't know if I can live with this, Mark." She said, "I'm going to have to go up and pray about this." And when she told me she had to go upstairs in her study and pray about it, I knew I was in trouble. She came back down about an hour later and she said, "Mark, I've made a decision and I'm at peace with it. And God wants me to do this. With you only 7 months in this crime, and it's been going on for 12 years, and you're only involved in the company for 3 years so far, God wants me to force you to turn yourself into the FBI. And if you don't turn yourself into the FBI, I want to let you right now, I'm turning you in. But you are going to go. And if you go to prison, which I don't think you will, by being involved with this crime such a little period of time, but if you go to prison, I'll stay with you, and I'll support you 100%. But she said, Mark, I'd rather be homeless than live in a house where illegal activity is going on, and you're going to turn yourself in today. And I've known my wife since the seventh grade, and I knew she meant it. I knew she meant it. And that gentleman is the difference between a whistleblower and an informant. A whistleblower is someone that will sacrifice everything to do the right thing. That's my wife, Ginger. An informant is someone that wears a wire to get a lower sentence and less punishment. That's me. But that's the difference between a whistleblower and informant. So the same day I told my wife a case that was going on for 12 years, I was confessing for 4 hours with the FBI with my wife by my side. I don't know how many of you ever went to the FBI and told them you're stealing $1 billion a year, but I tell you, it's an interesting reaction. That phone was ringing off the hook. That phone in Decatur, Illinois, reached the Attorney General, reached William Sessions at the time, who was director of the FBI. This became the largest price-fixing case in U.S. history. If you go to the FBI museum today, at the FBI headquarters, there's a section of the equipment that I wore undercover for the FBI and the museum. This was that large of a case. This was a $1 billion theft for 12 years in a row. So when we were done, here I was, 35 years old, my wife, 34. We didn't have any lawyer with us. We just did all this on our own, and we were naive. So when we were done, my wife said, well, look, my husband came in. He did the right thing. You guys can go tap phones and do whatever you do now, but we can go home now, right? The FBI said, your husband can't go home. He just confessed to a $1 billion a year crime. He either has to I have to arrest him today, or he has to start wearing a wire tomorrow. And that's how I became an FBI informant. Met the FBI agent at 6 o'clock in the morning, got my chest shaved, got wired up, and then wore a wire every day after that for 3 years, Monday through Friday for 3 years. I don't have the normal resume of a white-collar criminal. Went to Ohio State University, full scholarship for bachelor's and master's, full scholarship for PhD at Cornell University in biochemistry. By the way, I showed this slide in Michigan at the prayer breakfast there, and I said, I don't have the resume of a white-collar criminal, and 800 people in the audience, someone stood in the back, and they said, that is a resume of a white-collar criminal to go to Ohio State University. So I know I can't use that slide in Michigan. As you know, Ohio State and Michigan are quite rivals there. These meetings were all around the world. They were in Decatur, Illinois, some. They were in Zurich. They were in Mexico City. They were in Vancouver. Two or three meetings a month where we'd get together with our competitors. We had an international cartel, and we fixed the price of those ingredients to the point where each company involved got an extra $1 billion a year. Not a million, but an extra $1 billion a year added to their bottom line with this crime. Following around the world with us was this green lamp. This green lamp had the video camera in it. The FBI knew they were going up against one of the biggest companies in the world. ADM spent $70 million on legal fees in defending themselves. This was a seven-week trial, $70 million in legal fees spent. The FBI knew that was going to happen, that it was going to be against a very big company, the 56th largest company on the Fortune 500. So they wanted to make video of this where they could show a jury what was going on, not just the jury to hear the audio tapes that I was wearing. So this green lamp had the video camera in it, and the FBI would always be in the next room, and they could control that camera left or right or zoom it in or move it up or down from a monitor and a remote controller from the next room in that green lamp. And gentlemen, that green lamp was at the Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore, 5 feet from where the 11 of us were sitting. 2 weeks later, that green lamp was in the Mandarin Hotel in Hong Kong with the same 11 guys, 5 feet from where those 11 guys were sitting. 3 weeks after that, that green lamp was at the Four Seasons Hotel in Chicago, 11 guys, 5 feet from where they were sitting. That green lamp was at two or three meetings a month all around the world for 3 years. And not one of them caught it. And I thank God that the 11 guys stealing $1 billion each for all their own companies were all men. Because I'm convinced with that green lamp that looks like it came from a yard sale, if we had a woman among us, she would have said, you know what, that green lamp sitting right by us, that was with us 2 weeks ago in a different country, and that thing's following us around the world. But one thing I noticed, 3 years undercover, that greed blinds you. Greed blinds you. That lamp was 5 feet from them two or three times a month for 3 years. And they never saw it because all they could see was dollar signs in their head. Greed blinds you, and I saw it firsthand. One of the tape recorders that I used in Irvine in California was in the briefcase. The FBI did not have near the sophisticated equipment 22 years ago, 1992, as they have today. And in this briefcase was the tape recorder that I had. And this is the actual briefcase. That tape recorder started clicking when I was at this Irvine Marriott Hotel. So here I had a briefcase malfunction, so to speak. My tape recorder clicking. A lamp sitting a few feet from everybody where they were sitting, where they already passed, following them around for a year, because this was 1993. I opened that briefcase to fix that recorder. Not one person saw me open it. Not one person heard the clicking. Not one person saw the lamp. I tell you, I lived it out for 3 years. That greed blinds you. They didn't see what was going on because all they could see is watching that easel and someone writing on that flip chart how much money they were going to make when we made these decisions to work together in this international cartel. After 2 years wearing a wire, I was spent. Keep in mind, I wore one for 3 years every day. But after 2 years, I was spent. I didn't know if I worked for ADM. I didn't know if I worked for the FBI. I didn't know who I was. At the Quantico FBI Academy a couple years back, they told me a guideline. It's not a requirement, but a guideline. They try not to take an informant undercover longer than a year wearing a wire because they saw what happened when someone wears one for three with me. I was having a breakdown. So after 2 years wearing a wire, and there's a very accurate depiction on this on a Discovery Channel documentary on my website called markwhitaker.com. It's where the four FBI agents, the prosecutor, my wife and I, all the real people involved with this case, got together and did a documentary in 2010. And it's on my website, free of charge on my website by Discovery Channel. And in this, the longest scene in this Discovery Channel documentary is about what I'm ready to describe. It's 3 a.m. I got my microphones taped to my chest. I got the tape recorder still on my back. And I'm blowing leaves off during a thunderstorm with my shirt and tie on at 3 a.m. during a horrific thunderstorm at my home outside of Decatur, Illinois. My wife heard the gas leaf blower from the bedroom. She comes out with an umbrella over her head. And they show this on Discovery Channel. They had actors reenact this part out. She comes out on the driveway. She says, "Mark, come back to the house. Come back to the family. You got to meet the FBI at 6. Like you do every morning. It's 3 a.m. This is crazy, you out here." She said, "Most importantly, Mark, you need God in your life." And I looked at her and said, "Why do I need God? They just announced Fortune magazine 2 months ago. When our 69-year-old president retires, I'm taking his place. I'm going from divisional president to company president. I'm going from number 4 to number 2 when our 69-year-old president retires. So why do I need God?" She looked at me, she said, "Mark, you are delusional. And boy, do you ever need God." She said, "You're delusional to think you're going to be the next president." She said, "I realize they announced it, but they don't know you're the informant." She said, "The 17 board members have been there for 25, 30 years. The CEO's been there that long. The president's been that long. The board members are friends and family, those 17 board members. They're going to fire you when they learn you wore a wire all this time. Surely you don't think you're going to work there and show back at work when the other three go to prison and you just show up at work like nothing happened." That's how delusional I was getting wearing that wire that long. I thought I was just, it'd all be over with, and I'd just be president, just going like life was normal. She walked back in the house and I started thinking, gosh, I'm obsessed with that lifestyle. I've had that job by that point for 7 years. That's $3 million a year for almost 7 years with bonuses and stock options and base salary. I couldn't imagine life without it. How would I handle this? How quick could I get another job that's a similar job? Well, whistleblowers and informants aren't too popular in corporate America. So it's going to be pretty tough to get another job. Actually, easier to get a job as a felon than it is a whistleblower. So I thought, well, it's 1994. You look at New York Times, Wall Street Journal, they get these multi-million dollar golden parachutes when they get fired. So I'll probably get me a $20 or $30 million golden parachute when they fire me. Then I thought, well, there's only three people above me to make that decision, and they're going to jail. They're not going to give me a golden parachute. They're going to hate me. I'm going to be a witness against them. So then I started thinking, well, I went to Cornell. I'm a smart guy. How am I going to handle this? And I thought, boy, I'm a really smart guy when I made this decision, and you're going to see how stupid this decision was. I thought, well, They just announced I'm the next president 2 months ago. So I write my own golden parachute. I write my own severance package. Accountants are scared to death of me. The employees are scared to death of me being number four and about ready to move to number two in the company. So I decide I'd go and write checks for $9 million, which is 3 years of my total compensation. They give me 3 years severance package to get back on my feet. 3 years what I'm used to earning. $3 million a year for 3 years is $9 million. I went to work the next day and started processing checks, wrote five checks over a couple months' time, $9 million. I thought, boy, I'm the smartest guy in the room, I thought. When I get fired, I got my severance package all worked out. They couldn't turn me in. How could they turn me in for $9 million? They're stealing $1 billion a year for 12 years in a row. There's only three people above me involved with a bigger fraud. If the accountants would tell the company that I was stealing money, the management, well, they're stealing $1 billion a year for 12 years in a row. They could turn me in and it'd be impossible with the fraud that they were involved with. Until the day they learned I was the informant, everything changed. The day they learned I was the mole, and then I realized how stupid that decision was. They contacted the media. They contacted the FBI. And they said, Mark Whitaker's no white, not informant. He stole $9 million from us the same time he's working for the FBI. Well, gentlemen, they went to prison for price fixing, where I told on them. And I went to prison for $9 million fraud, where they told on me. We all went to prison for something different. We all just told on each other. The amazing thing is, when the FBI knew about that $9 million, they came to my house, had my wife and I in our family room, and they said, Mark, you had full immunity signed by the U.S. attorney, never be charged. All you had to do is not do something stupid. You've lost this immunity agreement. You can't steal $9 million and we still give you immunity. But we're going to get you the best plea agreement we can get you because we know you're under pressure and you made some poor decisions after wearing a wire as long as we force you to wear a wire. So we're going to get the best plea agreement we can get you. Those FBI agents went to the U.S. attorney in Chicago and said, Mark Whitaker wore a wire for 3 years. We never gave him any mental health counseling. The FBI agents have to see a psychiatrist every 3 months when they go undercover to help them deal with a double life. They said, we didn't help Mark at all because he was a civilian. Got no mental health counseling. They told the prosecutor, said, Mark Whitaker stole $9 million when his mental stability was at its worst. When he was not sleeping, staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning and meeting us at 6 o'clock in the morning for 3 years. And the prosecutor agreed, said, you know what? Mark Whitaker helped solve a $12 billion crime. $1 billion a year for 12 years. And he stole $9 million, which is minuscule compared to what he helped. We give him a 6-month plea agreement in a white-collar camp with no fence. 6 months in federal prison with no camp for a plea agreement. For his assistance for wearing a wire as long as he did. Deal of a lifetime. My lawyer called me in Chicago. He's now a judge. He called me in Chicago. He said, Mark, the FBI got you deal of a lifetime. 6 months in federal prison, and this is all behind you. Ginger said, sign it, Mark. Let's put this behind us. It'll be over with in 6 months. I was so mad at Ginger at that time. I said, well, you're the one that forced me to become an informant in the first place. So I wanted to do the opposite of what she wanted me to do. And I said, the FBI told me every day, I told my lawyer, I said, when they wired me up, they said, if these guys catch you, they'll kill you. And I risked my life and I'm going to go to prison for 6 months. I said, I won't accept it. I threw the plea agreement in the trash can, fired that lawyer on the spot, hired a whole group of lawyers starting the next day, and fought that case for 3 years to get a 10-and-a-half-year sentence 3 years later. And had a 6-month plea agreement in hand to get a 10-and-a-half-year sentence 3 years later. I had full immunity for wearing a wire. And then I got a 6-month sentence, even with a $9 million fraud, which was a gift. And then I blew that to a 10-and-a-half-year sentence 3 years later. I was my own worst enemy every step of the way. Every step where they were trying to help me, I cut their legs out from under them. And my wife has done a lot of interviews on this case. And one of the things they asked my wife, they said, Ginger Whitaker, how'd you do it? The divorce rate, if someone goes to prison, is 78% divorce rate if you go to prison. It's 99% divorce rate if you serve 5 years and longer. In federal prisons, there's no parole. You get 15% off good behavior. So I do 8 years and 8 months on that 10.5 year sentence. And they asked my wife, how'd you do 9 years in prison when the divorce rate is 99%? And my wife says this, divorce was never an option. God wouldn't allow it. But she said murder was an option. She considered it twice. And I can tell you, when she heard about the $9 million, I set it aside. She said murder was on the table. Good thing the FBI agents were with me when she heard about it. And when I took a 6-month deal and threw it in a trash can and said I'd never take that deal, only get a 10.5 year sentence 3 years later, murder was definitely back on the table. So I went just like Martha Stewart, just like Michael Milken, just like the WorldCom executives, the Enron executives, national TV, from corporate jet to handcuffs and jail. And not for 6 months, for 8 years and 8 months. Age 41 going in, 49, age 49 coming out, all of my 40s in federal prison. And I had full immunity for wearing that wire. And the worst part about it is when the FBI was at my house, when they were telling me they were going to fight for the plea agreement, they sat there and told my wife and I that there's called a Lou Peters Award, which is the highest civilian award that the FBI can get out, called a Lou Peters Award. They already had filed for a Lou Peters Award for me wearing a wire for 3 years before they knew about the $9 million. And they also were already filing for a QITAM Award. That's which would have been 15% of what they collected from the government. They collected a $100 million fine from ADM, the government did, which meant I would have got $15 million. They were giving me $15 million in processing that, and I stole nine. My own worst enemy every step of the way. So that's where the movie ended. That's what the movie was about, The Informant. That's Ginger and I with my identical twin, Matt Damon. Think you can see why they chose him. I'm the one on the right, by the way, if you can't tell which one I am. And these are some of the books and movies and stuff on this case. The book, The Informant, by New York Times. Very good book, very serious drama. Rats in the Grain, written by an attorney, very detailed, I think, documents this case very well. Against All Odds came out 10 years later. That came out in 2010. That's really our faith journey. It's sold in Christian bookstores about how our family survived it. And really mostly about my wife, how she held some things together during some very turbulent times. And then the movie The Informant, which is a comedy of the book, The Informant by New York Times. And then the Discovery Channel documentary. The FBI didn't like the movie being a comedy, so they initiated a documentary that came out 6 months after the movie. And that's on my website called markwhitaker.com with all the real agents involved and my wife and I and all the real people involved. So that's where the movie ended. It was a crime drama where the four top guys of ADM went to federal prison. And it ended there. Did life end when I went to federal prison? I thought it was. I thought it was ending at that time in my life. But I want to talk about the rest of the story. When I had a 10.5 year sentence and knowing that I had a 6 month sentence that I could have had, I wrote a 17-page letter to my wife. I wrote letters to all my kids. And I pulled my car in one of those garages and tried to kill myself. I could not imagine going to prison for 9 years. I wasn't even willing to go for 6 months. You can imagine how I felt to go to prison for 9 years. I couldn't put my head around it. And I tried to kill myself. Became hopeless and helpless during that time. I was hospitalized for a month. I was treated for post-traumatic stress disorder from wearing a wire for 3 years. I was treated for bipolar disorder. That's kind of a manic moment when you're blowing driveway off at 3 a.m. during a thunderstorm, writing 5 checks to yourself, throwing a 6-month deal in a trash can. The psychiatrist felt like there were some manic moments there. So treated for bipolar disorder, stabilized and sent home after about a month of treatment. And after about a month of treatment, the judge gave me 7 months before I had to show up in prison. 7 months to get my house in order before I left for a decade in federal prison. And all I could think about is finding another way to kill myself and be effective this time. Someone came to our house. His name was Ian Howes. He read about me in the newspaper. I was only home about a week from a month of hospitalization. I was home for about a week. And he said, he came to my house, he said, Mark, I want to let you know something. I read about you in the paper, read about your case, read about the 6-month deal, read about now you're going 9 years to federal prison. And he said, I want to let you know, prison's going to be the beginning of your life, and you're going to find your true purpose in life with the journey you're ready to start, is what he told me. I ran back in the kitchen, told my wife, I said, honey, there's somebody out on the porch that's crazier than I am. She said, that can't be. And then I told her what he said. She fell to her knees and started crying and said, I've been praying for someone in your life to show up, that God would send somebody that maybe you would listen to, because you sure had not listened to me for the last 20 years. So I went back out and I said, Ian, what do you have in mind? I got 7 months. I'm leaving for a decade. He was CFO of a large pharmaceutical company, still is today. 5 young children at that time. This is fall of 1997, 18 years ago. 5 young children. He's with a group called Christian Businessmen Connection, volunteer, along with his job. And he said he had a study called Operation Timothy. I don't know if many of you ever heard of Operation Timothy. It's a study that introduced you to Jesus, introduced you to God. But it's really more the relationship, someone to walk alongside of you in your life, in your journey. He said he normally spends about an hour a week for about a year, year and a half, taking somebody through Operation Timothy. But he said, Mark, you're leaving in 7 months for a decade. So he'd like to spend 6, 7, 8 hours a week with me. CFO of a company with 5 young children. 6, 7, 8 hours a week, he went through Operation Timothy, introduction to the Bible, introduction to Jesus with me. First thing I told him, I said, Ian, I've been going to church my whole life. My parents forced me to go as a kid. I've been going with my wife and kids ever since I've been married. I said, I'm a Christian. I go to church. He said, Mark, being a Christian is not going to church. He said, do you have God in your heart? I said, well, I tithe. I go to church. I've been going for years. He said, Mark, do you have God in your heart? I said, no, I don't have him in my heart. He said, Mark, you're not a Christian. And I said, Ian, I think my sins are too big for God to forgive me. I stole $9 million. Look what I've done to my family. I'm getting ready to leave for a decade. My wife hadn't worked for over 10 years. Stay-at-home mom raising 3 young children. I said, look at the sins. God can never forgive that. And we'd spend hours going through Scripture. Hours where God will forgive you no matter what sin you've done. No matter how big you've done. Then I said, Ian, well, why would God forgive me? Why would he do it? And he said, he sent his son. We spent hours. When I'm talking to you in a couple minutes, we spent hours. He said, God sent his only son, Jesus, to die on a cross for my sins. His only son, he sacrificed for my sins and died a horrific death on the cross. And then I said, Ian, but how do I get to God? I can't feel him. I'm a biochemist. I can't see the evidence. How do I feel him? How do I touch him? He said, Mark, the way you get to God, the bridge to God is Jesus. You believe in Jesus? Jesus died for your sins. Jesus was resurrected and ascended back to heaven. You believe in that? Then you believe in God. And God will forgive you. And he'll give you a clean slate and you'll have eternal life. Your soul will, after you're finished here on earth. By the way, Operation Timothy was only by book then. They have a wonderful electronic version now that's all electronic, and it's free, Operation Timothy. A wonderful program to introduce somebody to Jesus just by going on cbmc.com to get that Operation Timothy. A couple weeks after I entered prison, this man showed up. So Ian Howell's discipled me for 7 months. I'm 2 weeks now in prison. Ian's planted a good seed, but I'm still not there yet. He's still working with me. Then Chuck Colson showed up. I didn't even know who he was. He said he went to Brown University. I went to Cornell. We both went to Ivy League schools. He said he read about me in the Washington Post. He said I showed up in the front page of the newspapers about like he did years earlier in the mid-70s. He said he became top of his game as a White House counsel under President Nixon, an office right next to the Oval Office. He said, Mark, you became top of the game in corporate America. He said only for both of us to end up in federal prison for $20 a month. And he said it was the best thing in the world that ever happened to him. And he started telling me the same things Ian Howells was telling me. And Chuck Colson mentored me and discipled me for 9 years in federal prison. He poured his life into me. And for the first 6 years that I got out of prison, I've been out for 9 years now, he poured his life into me till he died 3 years ago last month, April 21st, 2012. And he was like a father to me, and I will never forget Chuck Colson or Ian Howells. In 2 Corinthians 5:20, it says, as believers, we're ambassadors for Christ. We're his ambassadors if you're a believer. Well, let me tell you something. I met 2 ambassadors face-to-face with Ian Howells and Chuck Colson. Face-to-face. My third month in prison, June 4th, 1998, I got down on my knees in a concrete floor, a 10 by 10 concrete floor, and a roommate in a locker. And I had a 13,000 square feet house for the 7 years before that. I got down on my knees on a concrete floor and surrendered my life to Jesus Christ. My third month in prison, even though I went to church almost my whole life, it was the first time I prayed and the first time I surrendered my life to Jesus. I had 8.5 years yet to go. I felt a peace and contentment even immediately after crying and surrendering my life to Jesus. I said, Jesus, I made a train wreck of my life and my family's life, and I need to turn this steering wheel over to you. And I turned it over to him. He gave me a peace and contentment that I'd never felt. I basically became a free man in prison, and I was imprisoned to those 7 years before to that job that I had in corporate America. That was prison, that greed addiction, that addiction to power and greed. And I was a free man in prison. In prison, you got 24 hours a day free time. Only thing I had to show up for is breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So I had 22 and a half hours a day free time. And in my third month in prison, I surrendered my life to Jesus. I said, God, during one of my quiet time period, I said, God, what's my purpose? Ian Howes and Chuck Colson said I'd find my purpose. What is my purpose? I looked at one morning those Operation Timothy books, and I got it. What better place where people are hopeless and helpless than federal prison? There's 700 inmates where I was. I took 61 people one-on-one through Operation Timothy in federal prison. I helped them get their GEDs, learn how to read, learn how to write. They became the most rewarding years. I couldn't wait to get up to see who maybe I could help. At $20 a month, they became the most rewarding years of my life. 58 years old now, and I'd say the 9 most rewarding years of life were in federal prison. Because for the first time in my life, I was helping somebody else besides myself. I found out what a servant leader is all about and how little that selfish leadership is, how little rewarding that is. And I want to make a comment on this. When people would drive by our house when I was 32 years old, they would look at that house behind gates, and we had security guards and everything, and they'd say, that man has everything, a mansion, an 8-car garage, access to a corporate jet, number 4 executive, one of the biggest companies in the world. And I tell you something, that was an empty life. For the young people out here that are shooting for that, I want to tell you, that was an empty life. I kept thinking moving up that corporate ladder, it was going to get me where I'm happy. But every time I got there, I'm saying, what's next? What's next? I could have got to the level of Bill Gates, and I'd be saying, what's next? If you think money's going to fill that void, I can tell you from somebody who's been there, it's not going to fill it. It's not going to fill that void. But Jesus did. As a family, we got better and not bitter. 2 ways to come out of prison. 2 ways to come out of any adversity that any of you are going to go through. And all of you are going to go through adversity. 2 ways to go through it. You get better or you get bitter. We got better. And the difference is if you got God in your life, you'll get better. And the only difference between those 2 words is the letter E. E for eternal value is the only difference between those 2 words, better or bitter. And the difference is having God in your life. God pardoned me and he redeemed me on June 4th, 1998. And he gave me a second chance. And he gave me a clean slate. And then he touched the hearts of society to forgive me. And let me give you a couple examples. My family, I mentioned a 99% divorce rate if you serve 5 years and longer. In federal prison, with good behavior, you can go to a better place. I started off in a camp in Yazoo, Mississippi. A couple years later, I was in Edgefield, South Carolina, a better camp where I applied to go. If you look at federal prisons' Forbes list, they rank federal prisons just like they do universities. And Pensacola, Florida Navy Base is ranked number 1. So eventually I got to do my last 4.5 years there. I went to Cornell for my PhD, and I went to Pensacola Prison for my prison time. Both of them number 1 in their fields. And my wife moved to each of those places, walking distance from 3 prisons. She moved to 3 different states. They allow your family to come in a visiting room setting Friday nights and then all day Saturday and all day Sunday. She came 20 hours a weekend, which is the maximum allowable hours for 9 years, her and my kids. And Against All Odds, the book written about mostly about my wife, they added her days up from prison records, how long she spent sitting in federal prison, and her days added up to 3 years and 8 months. her and my kids. 3 years and 8 months, she sat 8 hours a day in federal prison with a 99% divorce rate, with about five wives coming out, about 700 inmates. It's a miracle of God that my family stayed with me. Our youngest son was 6 years old when I went undercover. Six. He was 12 years old when I was in seventh grade. 12. When I went to prison, 12 years old in seventh grade. He was 21 and in college, a junior in college, when I got out of prison. Age 6 to age 21. And I watched my son in December stand in front of a group of CBMCers in Cincinnati, 40 guys. And he said, thank God that his dad went to prison, because he got to know his father by me going to prison. And he said it was a blessing that I went to prison, where he finally got to know me by spending 20 hours a weekend with me. It's a miracle of God that my family still love me today after what I put them through. That's my family today. My wife and I and our three kids, and the one that looks the most like us is our daughter-in-law, not our child, the one right behind my wife. And not only did we survive, we thrived. Closer and stronger than ever. Better, not bitter, and the only reason is because God in our lives. The food companies we're stealing from, Kraft, Coca-Cola, Kellogg's, Pepsi, all the companies you'd buy some of your groceries from, Tyson, Kraft, Pillsbury. The food companies we stole from got reimbursed $3 billion back from the class action suits. ADM paid $100 million government fine and $3 billion back, the 11 companies did, back to the clients. Coca-Cola alone won $400 million. One of the guys was a Christian out of those 11 companies that won reimbursed for that theft. Tyson Foods was a Christian. He got the other 11 guys on a call, and he had the law firm that represented him, Dick Stein and Shapiro in Washington, D.C., was representing these companies to be reimbursed for these class action suits for this price-fixing theft. And this guy from Tyson Foods, general counsel, said, if it wasn't for Ginger Whitaker, price fixing would still be going on like it was for 12 years. If it wasn't for Mark Whitaker wearing a wire, it'd never been exposed. Even with the mistakes he made, it would have never been exposed. And look what that woman, Ginger Whitaker, is going through. Those companies put a trust fund together that took care of my family for 9 years. They put an $800,000 trust fund together, which was about $100,000 a year, where my family could survive, because my family was about ready to move back at home with her parents, with our three kids. That's a miracle of God, to take the people who I stole from, took care of my family for 9 years. If that's not an example of redemption, I don't know what is. That's a whole chapter in the new book called Against All Odds. I thought I'd never be able to get my career back. I learned air conditioning and heating in prison, and I think it would have been a great field, and I learned it well. When I get into something, I learn it well. You have a choice in prison to learn to be to drive a truck, long-haul driving, or air conditioning and heating. I just fixed mine about 3 weeks ago. If you need yours fixed, talk to me. So I took that in prison because I wanted to be able to support my family when I got out, because I thought I'd never be able to go back in my corporate career. Cornell University, 2 years before I got out, they were keeping up with me the whole time I was in prison. I graduated there in 1983. I got out of prison in 2006, 23 years later, and I still had professors there that I studied with 23 years later. They were in their 40s then, and they're in their 60s and 70s now. And they started lobbying for me to get a job when I got out of prison. They had four offers for me waiting the day I got out of prison in pharmaceutical and biotech companies that would use my PhD in biochemistry. Four offers. Now, by the way, for the young people, I want to make it clear, you don't start off the head of finance when you steal $9 million. But they had a job for me. I chose a job that had a Christian CEO. I had a greed addiction. I didn't want to fall back in that trap. So I chose a job with a Christian CEO where I've been in the last 9 years since I got out. And I started off at the bottom. I've had four promotions. I've been there, and I was promoted most recently to COO and Chief Science Officer, the number two executive at a prostate cancer research company, overall finance. That's a miracle of God. God took care of every one of these steps. Thank you. Thank you. The FBI agents and prosecutors, you think they would hate me. I stole $9 million when I worked for them. Threw a six-month deal in a trash can. You think they'd hate me. I want to show a news clip. It's about a minute and a half long. And you'll see they became my biggest supporters. And talking about an example of redemption and second chances, I'm convinced this can only be the case because of God touching hearts. And I'll show you this news clip, a 2010 news clip, which is kind of recent for a case that's 1992. It's from the head of the FBI talking about what he feels about what happened in this case and what he feels about me. And this is just a minute and a half clip, but there's an hour show like this on Discovery Channel with the same kind of support. So I'm going to go to this news clip, and then we'll wrap this up.
Dean Paisley is what you'd expect a 25-year veteran of the FBI to be. He's a very honest, straight shooter, and he knows Mark Whitaker very well. He was the FBI supervisor in the ADM Mark Whitaker price-fixing case. And he says this question mark should not be on this title. He says that he has no question that Mark Whitaker is a national hero. But in the early 1990s, Mark Whitaker was keeping a $9 million secret from Dean Paisley. And it was a secret he would regret.
My biggest regret would be that I didn't tell the FBI about the money issue during the time that I was working with the FBI.
But those in the FBI who were working with Mark Whitaker to build a case against ADM were shocked when their own informant was sent to prison for 9 years.
It was the first time in history that anybody had been a cooperative witness for the FBI and was prosecuted in the same case that they were assisting. It doesn't make sense.
Dean Paisley worked for the FBI for 25 years. He was the FBI supervisor during the Mark Whitaker ADM case. He is not a fan of the movie The Informant.
I know from experience going through that that it wasn't a comedy. It was anything but a comedy.
Would you be willing to wear a wire? We need your help.
And the 25-year FBI veteran is also not laughing at the treatment that Mark Whitaker has received.
I always felt that he didn't get a fair shake, either from the FBI or the system. He didn't deserve all that happened to him.
Dean Paisley is now working to get a presidential pardon for Mark Whitaker, who he says is a national hero.
He helped every citizen in this world that ever bought any product from ADM. Had he not stolen that $9 million, he would have been a national hero at the highest levels, really.
Dean Paisley says he and the other main FBI officers who worked this case are now pressing for a full presidential pardon for Mark Whitaker. And at least one prosecutor who helped send Whitaker to prison is also helping in their effort.
That's a miracle of God. When you think what I did to those FBI agents, you think they'd just throw away the key and forget about me completely. I tell you, it's been quite a journey in the last 25 years. And I can't imagine that I'd be alive today and my family together today if it wasn't for God. Chuck Colson did 38 events at age 80. 38 events at age 80, the year he passed in 2012. I did 91 events last calendar year. I'll do a similar number of events this year to groups like yourself. And I will get on a plane and share what Jesus did in my life until I can't do it anymore. I was in Knoxville last Thursday. I was in Pittsburgh on Friday. I did 5 events here since Saturday. I'm heading from here tomorrow afternoon to Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I will share what Jesus done in my life until I can't get on a plane anymore, like Chuck Colson. Because I don't think there's anything more important than being a witness for Jesus Christ. And what better place to be a witness than the marketplace? Did you know that Jesus, out of 132 public appearances in Scripture, 132, did you know 122 of his public appearances were in the marketplace? 92% of his public appearances were in the marketplace, not in the temple or the synagogue. Jesus has shown us by example, what better place for ministry than the marketplace where we work? Just like Ian Howes, who reached out to me, and Chuck Colson, who reached out to me. They saw me that as part of their work with me being in the sphere of influence. Think about the Mark Whitakers that are out there, that are lost, that are on this hamster wheel of life and chasing things that's a false dream that they're chasing. What better place to reach them than the marketplace? The 12 disciples under Jesus. Where'd they come from? It wasn't the Pharisees in the temple or the synagogue. The 12 disciples came from the market, the marketplace. Fishermen, a doctor, tax collectors, all 12 of them. Where did Jesus send them? On Matthew 28:19. And Jesus said, go and make disciples of all nations. He said, as you go, go making disciples of all nations. He sent them back to the marketplace. All of us and all of you here, we have a great responsibility. 2 Corinthians 5:20 makes it so clear. We are his ambassadors. We are. If you're a believer, you are his ambassador. The only question, how effective an ambassador are we going to be? Are we going to be a tourist and sit on the sidelines? Or are we going to get engaged like Chuck Colson and Ian House did? And I'm urging and challenging every one of you. Take that responsibility seriously. Take it seriously. And reach the unconvinced and the lost that are out there that don't know God. And tell them what God has done in your life. That way they have the opportunity to God work through them like they did for you. And be a witness for Jesus. I urge you and I challenge each and every one of you. Because there's nothing more important in our life than that. Our houses, our cars, our wives, our kids. God owns every square inch of this universe. We're only the stewards of these things. We're his ambassadors for these things, but God owns every... The thing that I heard Chuck Colson the most say, close to 1,000 times, I'm sure, in the 15 years, God owns every square inch of this universe. And if he does, what better way to serve him and represent him until we meet him in heaven, until we're with him in heaven? And I urge you and challenge all of you. Thanks for the opportunity to be here and share with you today. And God bless all of you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I have one more thing I'd like to add. One more thing, and we're going to have a Q&A. But one more thing I'd like to add is this. The most frequent question my wife and I get is this. What would have happened, Mark, if you would have signed that 6-month plea agreement? What would have happened? That's a Martha Stewart sentence. I would have came out the same man that I went in. Chuck Colson and Ian Howes wouldn't even read about me, so they wouldn't have been visiting me. Even if they would have, I wouldn't have listened to them with a 6-month sentence. And my wife says the same thing. God gave me exactly what I needed, and I needed 9 years in federal prison. A 6-month sentence would not have changed me. So thank God he gave me 9 years in jail. Thank you very much, and be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you. Any questions? The role of money, when I got out, I had a very, very good corporate job right when I got out of prison. I had $740,000 I still owed to lawyers. I had a couple $1 million that I still owed on my fines. My wife and I did everything we could to live on about 25% of what I earned until I paid all that off, and we did. We live in a $315,000 house, which is a nice house. But it's a $350,000 house. We felt that was something that God would honor. We have 2 cars, a Ford Fusion and a Ford Escape. We could have had something nicer, but we felt that's what God honors. We go to a prison almost once a month. We've been to 12 prisons in the last 12 months. It cost my wife $2,000 or $3,000 for our airfare, hotels, and so on to go to these prisons. We pay it out of pocket to do that. In the last couple of years, I've not even taken a salary from my company at all. The last couple of years, I just went on the advisory board where I could go out and share what I'm sharing here today. So money is almost of non-importance. Enough to live on, enough for groceries, enough to have a decent house. But it's far from a 13,000-square-foot house with an 8-car garage. I have a 2012 Fusion. My wife has a 2009 Escape. And we're plenty happy with those. My wife became, the question was, how did my wife come to Christ? She became a Christian at age 13. Someone discipled her in junior high, someone she's still good friends with today. But her faith was young then, so I think when we got married, she was 20 and I was 21. We were both going to church, and I think there wasn't that unequally yoked because I was going to church, and her faith was not yet mature. But her faith started becoming growing. After we got married, it was growing exponentially. So her faith in God was growing exponentially, and my faith and my addiction to materialism was growing just as fast. And I think the reason why we had that discussion in 1992, because she was seeing that we were unequally yoked. And she wanted to see why I was going to church, but she wasn't seeing any fruit in my life. It's why that discussion started in the first place. Yeah. So she's been a Christian since she was 13. And she had the faith, and I'll never forget when I got sentenced on June 4th, 1998, to a 10-and-a-half-year sentence. I'm sitting in a county jail being ready to sign to federal prison. I'm watching my wife on TV. She's walking out on the steps of the courthouse. Very high-profile case. Had microphones from CBS, CNN, Fox News, and all them stuck in her face. And they said, Ginger Whitaker, how do you feel about this? And my wife said, we'll be okay. God's got everything under control, and this is what God wanted. My husband to be in prison for 9 years, and we're going to be just fine, is what she told every reporter. And they were looking at her, shaking her heads like she was crazy. And if they could go back now, she was right. My wife was right.
Hey, Mark. So, real quick, I want to ask a question. Can you talk just for a minute about what clicked when you went from being a guy who had ties for a long time, who grew up going to church, who went to church with his family for decades, and then you went through Operation Timothy, and then you get into jail, but it's still not for several months till after you get into jail before you hit your knees and you accept Christ. What kind of clicked to where you went from being someone who went to church and thought he was a Christian to someone who surrendered himself to Jesus Christ?
Well, first off, though, all those years that, like I said, my parents even forced me to go to church as a youngster, too. My parents, 88 years old, still say go to the same church they went to since teenagers. And they forced me to go there as a child. And then when I got married, I thought it was the right thing to do, but it was an intellectual. It was in the head. It wasn't in the heart during that time. And then when Ian Howe started going through Operation Timothy with me in September of 97, I was broken then. I had to get to the end of myself to really listen. Different people come to God different ways. We talked about how my wife came to God. But in my case, it took a sledgehammer. I had to get to the end of myself to get all those distractions out of the way. The cars, the house, the corporate jets. I had to get all those distractions out of the way before I would come to God. And when Ian Howe started meeting with me, Operation Timothy, seeds were being planted each of those times. Being a scientist, I had to review other scientists that believed in God and why they believed in God. Because in Cornell, all I learned was evolution and Darwinism. And, you know, it was the opposite of God what I was learning for a PhD at Cornell. So I went and reviewed other scientists, why they believed in God. Had an impact on me that Albert Einstein, as I was going through Operation Timothy, I was reviewing this, that Albert Einstein said the universe and man is impossible to come from the Big Bang Theory. Only God could create a man in the universe. I had a lot of respect for Albert Einstein as a scientist. Sir Isaac Newton, in his memoirs, said the same thing, that only God could create a man in the universe. Then there was a guy named Don Bierley. He wrote a book in 2003, but he was writing articles in 1997 and 1998 that became that book. He was a scientist out of University of Minnesota, a famous biologist. And he was trying to spend a decade trying to prove to his friends that God didn't exist, only to collect all the evidence and to write a book called Surprised by Faith that God does exist after he collected all the evidence. So he was writing those articles in 1997 and 98. So reading other scientists' work, why they believed in God, had a big impact on me. Now I look at my life with what God did, how my family stayed together with a divorce rate of 99%, how the companies I stole from took care of my family for 9 years, how the FBI and agents forgive me after everything I did for them, how I got employed 24 hours after I got out in the very field that I know in PhD in biochemistry. I don't live on faith now. I don't live on faith at all. I've seen the evidence. I've seen the evidence in my own life that I don't live just on faith. I've seen the evidence that God exists, because anybody could do what they did in my life to take that from ashes to beauty, only God could do that. And I've seen the evidence. Question was, if I ever speak, there are 30 people that went to prison. By the way, four people from ADM I keep talking about, but there were 11 companies involved. 2 years ago, my wife and I had lunch. There were four at ADM that went to prison, three of them that I testified against. 2 years ago, my wife and I met with one of those for lunch. He hugged me. He thanked me. He thanked me for wearing a wire. He thanked me for him going to prison. He became a Christian in prison. He said he had the same greed addiction I had, and he turned his life around and became a Christian, and he thanked me for wearing a wire. John Inlish and some of the others in here, John was at a conference that I was at in last September, one of the other companies. This guy was vice chairman of even the bigger company than ADM, lost everything. And he and his wife was there. He talked on stage that he considered having a hitman. He was vice chairman of Hoffman LaRoche, a bigger company even than ADM that was part of this price-fixing case. He talked about having a hitman, thought about having a hitman to go get me during that time. And on this stage, he thanked me. He became a Christian during this brokenness. And he turned his life around. He became the president of CBMC in Europe for 10 years. And John Inley, he saw it firsthand. So people come out of prison either better or bitter. The only difference is if they got God in their life. And a couple of the others that I did mention, they hate me with a passion. They came out bitter. They hate me that I wear a wire. The one that hates me the most is 97 years old now. But they hate me with a passion. They're still very bitter, even after all these years out of prison. You are a 29-year-old son. His name's Alex. I mentioned to you he was 6 when I went undercover. He was 12 when I went to prison. He was 21 when I got out of prison. And he's very active in CBMC. And I mentioned to you, it breaks my heart, he spoke to a CBMC group in December in Cincinnati, and he said the best thing in his life ever happened by his dad going to federal prison. I mean, he gives his testimony that he got to know his dad 20 hours a weekend with no distractions, no more of the jets, no more of the job. I didn't even have a cell phone or email in there. So no distractions for 20 hours a weekend, and how blessed he was to get to know his dad in federal prison. I told my wife it was on a Wednesday, and when I surrendered my life to Jesus Christ, and I told her that weekend, I said, "I get it, honey," and she fell to her knees. She was so happy. She's been praying about me for decades, praying for me for decades. So she was beyond elated and excited that I gave my life to Jesus. And she saw this peace and contentment in me and how I took that time about worried in prison and disappointed and depressed. And she saw me become productive and teach people how to get their GEDs and learn how to read and take them through Operation Timothy, and excited her so much that every weekend I was telling her what happened during the week there in federal prison, because there were 700 people that needed a lot of help. 700 people. Always changed my life tremendously. I don't feel there's anything more important than prayer. I even meet people still today that I haven't seen in a decade, and they were told me they were praying for me while I was in prison. Prayer is so important. I think starting your morning with quiet, whatever time you have. I like an hour of quiet time in the morning and pray. I pray before every conference call, every meeting. John Inlish and I, we did 5 events before we get to every one of those meetings. We pray for prepared hearts, that God guides us what words to be said. I think prayer is paramount. Prayer and worshiping God is one of the few things we can do here on earth that will continue in heaven. And we got to do as much of it as we can. As much of it as we can is pray. Very important. And scripture is very important in my life. One of the things that really sticks out to me is Colossians 3:23. And I try to remind myself of that several times a day. Whatever you do, do it with all your heart, like you're working for the Lord and not for man. Whatever you do, do it with all your heart, like you're working for the Lord and not for man. In Romans 8:28, my wife and I feel that's our life. That's everybody's life that knows God. That all things work together for good for those who love the Lord and live according to his purpose. He took our lives from ashes to beauty once I surrendered my life to him. Ashes to beauty. And I think you've seen what I described. Those are not coincidences. Those are miracles of God, what God has done in our lives. And that's why I said, There's nothing more important than being a witness for Jesus Christ. I don't like to travel. I don't like going through airports and so on. But I do 3 weeks a month. I do exactly what I'm doing here. I don't care if it's an at-risk youth. I went to Walker State Prison and talked to 1,500 inmates last month. Paid my own airfare and hotel, my wife and I did. There's nothing more important than this right here. Because there's a lot of Mark Whitakers out there. And just like Chuck Colson and Ian Howes did to me, I'm going to try to reach them, as many as I can. I can't change their life, but I can plant a seed where God can change their life. And I'm going to plant as many seeds as I can. The question was, I'll repeat the question where everybody hears it, how I do my regrets. There's not a day I wake up in the 9 years that I don't think about what I put my family through. I'm still very disappointed in myself. The hell that I put my wife and kids through, that didn't deserve any of that. So I still have all those regrets. And I still think about that every morning. But God still encourages me and turns that into positive. So it doesn't get erased, all those things. I feel like I'm in prison. I've been out of prison for 9 years, and I still feel, even though I'm out of prison, I still feel bad for what I did to my family and what I did to the FBI agents, but especially my family. So that's not erased. But they forgave me. They told me to move on. And we've moved on. But I do want to make it clear. I still wake up, look myself in the mirror and say, gosh, how did I do that? How did I do that mess? Well, the question was, how do I forgive myself knowing that God forgave me? I just kept with scripture and kept during my quiet time and knowing that God forgave me. And God wanted me to use all these mistakes I made to go out and share with others that feel like they've also made mistakes. That God will forgive you no matter what mistakes you made. And the point I try to make, if God can change Mark Whitaker, God can change anybody. Because I was a messed up character. Messed up. Selfish. All about me. And if God can change me, God can change anybody.
What role does confession play in your life now, and how do you deal with failure that you still go through, because your story's you're not perfect now after this redemption story?
So what was the question?
How do you deal with failures now, and what does confession look like in your life?
We're still. I mean, we're still, even though I'm not involved with price fixing or a $9 million fraud, we sin every day. If I look at the neighbor's house and say, "Boy, I'd like to have that house or car," I mean, all these are our sins, and I know I'm a broken vessel and a broken character. And what I do is just pray to God that I said, God, I know you sent your son, Jesus, for those sins. But during my prayer, I ask him every day to forgive me for whatever sins that I've done for that day. Because we continue to sin, even though not involved with a multi-billion-dollar crime. There's sin involved in all of our lives. But we know that God sent Jesus for our sins. And I know that now. That ever since Adam and Eve failed, that we're going to fail. But God's going to forgive us for those failures. God will forgive us. I did. Matt Damon, on the last day at the premiere time, we were with him till 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'll never forget this with Matt Damon. He made a comment. To my wife and I. His wife Luciana was there. And his wife Luciana was very impressed with the fact how our marriage survived. Hollywood marriages break up for the smallest of things, as you know. And then here's a marriage survived at 3 years undercover and 9 years in prison. And Matt Damon made a comment to Ginger and I that night, 1 o'clock in the morning, when we were about ready to part ways, and he's getting ready to move on to the next movie. He's done 6 movies since then. And he said, you know what? He said, we made the wrong movie. He said, this should have been a movie about a marriage surviving against all odds. And his wife was there. And he said, it just really touched us, seeing how we made it through so much and how much our faith was so important to us. And by him saying that, I don't believe he became a Christian that day or that night or during those weeks when they were filming. But I do believe this. I think it planted a seed in Matt Damon and his wife, Luciana, that he said, if that family can make it through that, there's something different that God's doing in their life that they're not, that they don't have. So I think it planted a seed with Matt Damon. Well, here's what I did. I was 7 years at another chemical company before ADM, and I was vice president of operations the last 2 years of that time, and I was doing a joint venture during those last 2 years. I was 2 years in New York with them, almost 4.5, 5 years in Germany with that company, and during the time that I was in Frankfurt, Germany, I was doing a joint venture with ADM out of Europe, and I got to know the CEO and the vice chairman. We worked really closely for 2 years, and they were impressed with some of the patents that I had and some of the things that we were accomplishing. And yes, and they were impressed with that. And I think another thing, too, looking back, I think they thought, here's a 32-year-old guy. He's hyper-ambitious. He'd do anything to move ahead. And if we bring him on board, he'd do some of the things that they would like to do. I think they saw a hyper-ambitious young man. But they knew me very well for 2 years before they hired me for that position. Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah.